I've just started the movie here, and I'm looking at a painting or a lithograph of a still life of somewhere in the mountains, listening to what sounds like announcements over an intercom of some sort. Credits are rolling here. It's a very limited perspective to start out with, but I'm excited to see where it all goes from here. Okay, so I've just finished the film, and honestly, I was blown away. Hello and welcome to Didion Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DH&I. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast. Hello, hello, and welcome to the show, the podcast classic. Happy Monday, y'all. Most of you don't know this tidbit, but I'm actually a huge film buff, so when I got the opportunity to write an episode about a film called The Farewell for my anthropology course, I immediately jumped at the challenge. I also wrote episode 107 called Discovering Apu for this course, so if you want a more thorough introduction to some of the topics that we've already discussed, I would go there. But by way of introduction, suffice to say that formal citations for everything I mentioned here are, as always, linked in the description down below. Oh, and one last thing. In this episode, I spoil the plot of the movie, but not the ending, hopefully to encourage you all to watch it for yourselves. Generally, The Farewell is a very emotional movie about a family's decision not to tell the grandmother of the family that she has stage 4 cancer and only a few months to live. The family then organizes a fake wedding for her grandson in order to create an excuse for everyone to return to China and say their final farewells. This practice of not informing the grandmother of her illness while challenging for people from the US is framed in the movie as a common practice for families in China. An article written by one of my professors this quarter, Professor Shankar, called Speaking Like a Model Minority: FOB Styles, Gender, and Racial Meanings Among Daisy Teens in Silicon Valley, quote, discusses what it means to be a model minority linguistically by examining how ideologies, class, and gender shape language use for Daisy South Asian American teenagers in a Silicon Valley high school, end quote. That was page 268. In the article, Shankar examines two different groups within that Silicon Valley high school, namely the cohort of upper middle class Daisy teens and the cohort of middle class Daisy teens, the latter category of which construct FOB, or so-called fresh off the boat speech styles. Both groups, since they go to the same high school, are part of a larger speech community, which for our purposes can be described as a community of speakers with regular contact and common linguistic traits or patterns, such as lexicon, between them. Though interestingly, each group in the article, the upper middle class Desi teens and then the FOBI teens, respectively, also realize their own smaller speech communities, which are simultaneously nested within the larger school-wide community and introduce their own styles and lexicons. Notably, the upper middle class teens are on the whole monolingual English users, and the FOBI teens are using varieties of Punjabi, Desi accented English. Both groups, since they go to the same high school, are part of a larger speech community, which for our purposes can be described as a community of speakers with regular contact and common linguistic patterns among them, such as lexicon. Though interestingly, each group in the article, the upper middle class Daisy teens and then the FOBI teens, respectively, also realize their own smaller speech communities, which are simultaneously nested within the larger school-wide community and also introduce their own styles and lexicons. Notably, the upper middle class teens are on the whole monolingual English users, especially at home and at school, and the FOBI teens use varieties of Punjabi, Daisy accented English, California slang, and hip hop lexicon. That list is also on page 268. Relating this study back to the movie, the first of many meals with the family all together is at timestamp 1827 in the film, and it's a cool moment because it's the first time that we see the family as a whole together, and we already see some rather glaring differences in terms of language between the family's individual groups. At the moment I just mentioned, for example, Hao, the grandson, is being singled out for not speaking Chinese, and his father, who we later find out identifies as principally Chinese despite his longtime residency in Japan, defends his son and encourages him to, quote, talk to his grandma in Chinese. Aside from its connection to the same sort of linguistic divisions that we see community making on different levels within the larger family here, for example, Hao and his father belong largely to a Japanese-speaking speech community, while the grandmother belongs to a Chinese-speaking speech community, there is also something to be said for the intersection between community and identity. In the Desi Teens article, speech simultaneously reflects identity and community membership. My estimation is that identity is a multi-layered, multifaceted trait, and there's a ton more I could say about it besides what I'll summarize it with, which is the thought that much of identity is about prioritization. By that I mean individuals prioritize different factors of their identities depending on those factors' usefulness in certain situations or based on their values as an individual. In the article, for example, wealth was a huge factor in identification with one or the other groups of Desi teens, so the occasion of the study and what Shankar was looking at brought about the prioritization of looking at wealth with relation to identity in in-group membership. The first we see of our main character, Billy, is at timestamp 1 minute 58 seconds in the film, and she's walking through the streets of New York City dressed in neutrals with a colorful street art backdrop behind her. She's being worried over by her grandmother, who is speaking to her over the phone from China. However, through a twist of dramatic irony, we, the audience, already know that it's not Billy, but her grandmother who we should be worrying about. As that print I was describing at the outset of the episode today was a decorative piece in a hospital waiting room. Like so much of our lives, The Farewell is a movie about community, so it's odd that the film starts out with two individuals who are, in their own ways, so alone, especially on screen. But as the film develops, you realize that one of its most prominent themes is loneliness and isolation. So those first shots at the beginning with these two characters juxtaposed against their comparatively colorful backgrounds start to feel like foreshadowing rather than a thematic error. Thus, let's talk about how language use influences our notions of community and identity with some help from Adrienne Lowe, who wrote an article called Code Switching, Speech Community, Membership, and the Construction of Ethnic Identity. Using transcripts from a conversation in 1955 involving, quote, Chaz, a Chinese-American, Ken, a Korean-American, and Rob, an African-American, unquote, all of whom, quote, are in their early 20s, unquote. That was page 462. I would be remiss not to point out that the subject matter of their conversation is problematic to say the least, as they discuss the, quote, desirability of Chinese, Vietnamese, and Korean women, unquote, page 61, but nevertheless, the way that these three individuals use language and switch between different varieties of English, Korean, and Japanese shows a lot about their identities and participation in certain speech communities. In particular, I want to talk about the point in the article where Rob leaves the conversation, which is at a point when the subject matter started to get increasingly sensitive, causing him, Rob, to point out, quote, everything's on tape, huh? 466. And eventually for the conversation to switch entirely to Korean, which excludes him outright. And the reason why I pinpoint this part of the article or transcripts, even though it's not by any means one of the vital parts of the article to understand Lowe's message, is that Rob's getting up and leaving signifies a very clear exclusion of language use, as Rob was not a Korean speaker, while Ken and Chaz were. To parallel in the conversation, Ken looked increasingly uncomfortable and indicated signs like pausing, nervous laughter, and refusal to switch to Korean, all to achieve similar ends to Rob, which were to refuse to continue to identify with the subject matter by also refusing to cooperate with Chaz's use of Korean, which involved marking certain derogatory language as distinctly Korean, which Ken did not agree with. The scene at 18 minutes and 27 seconds in the film that I mentioned a bit earlier, where Hao Hao's father is trying to get him to speak Chinese, is a similar scenario because by speaking Chinese to his grandmother, Hao Hao would be confirming his father's assertions that he is good at Chinese and just shy, meaning that he could show the table through language that he upholds the values that the family is indexing through language while they're eating together, such as their strong connection to each other, as well as strong respect for the matriarch. Language use in the movie also concerns our main character Billy, who moved from China to the US when she was 6 years old and therefore is a bilingual English and Chinese speaker, though she feels more comfortable speaking English. A scene that highlights language use, specifically with code switching, which is just switching between languages within the same conversation, really well in the film is at timestamp 47 minutes exactly, when a bilingual doctor arrives at the grandmother's bedside after she's checked herself in to change her medicine. Quote, "She still does not know about her condition at this point." When Billy finds out that the doctor also speaks English, she uses the opportunity to ask him about the morality of the family's decision to withhold the grandmother's diagnosis from her. And that's a conversation that Billy and the doctor can have in the room with the grandmother and other family members because, with the exception of Billy's father, they do not speak English. In this scene, then Billy code switches to confirm her introduced membership into the American speech community, with English, of course, as the doctor does to confirm his position with the British English speech community, I might add, but also to protect her grandmother from the information that they are withholding while asking his opinion on their decision. Finally, looking at identity more exclusively, Leanne Hinton wrote an article called Trading Tongues, Loss of Heritage Languages in the United States, which was pretty emotional for me to read because it, quote, excerpts language biographies of children of Asian immigrants who have grown up in America, unquote, i.e. me. That was page 21. And what I found particularly striking were the themes of shame, not only coming from the American side of things when you can't communicate with your parents in their native languages, but also when you visit family in other countries and have to deal with the shame of not being able to express yourself fully to them. In terms of identity, there are two scenes I want to discuss in the film, the first of which is another family dinner where Billy's mother is recounting a story of when they first arrived in America and were given the key to a church so that Billy could continue practicing the piano, even though her parents could no longer afford lessons. That timestamp is at 40 minutes and 33 seconds, and though spoken in Chinese, shows that Billy and her parents identify as American, especially when the other family members strictly say that they identify as Chinese, despite their plans to send their son to America for school. Next, at timestamp 50:13, is a scene right after the doctor's visit that I mentioned in the earlier section, where the family is discussing again the morality and the emotional gravity of their decision, especially considering the likelihood of the grandmother getting sicker and sicker as time goes on. Here, Billy chimes in, wanting to say that it would be illegal for them to do the same thing if the family lived in America, but she doesn't know the word for illegal in Chinese, which again isolates her when we think about this theme of isolation and relegates her to remembering and then even emphasizing her American identity in that moment. I also felt a similar sense of shame and again isolation in that moment, which certainly calls to mind the same themes that Hinton observes in her analysis of these linguistic biographies. Overall, The Farewell is such an incredible movie, not only for its filmic elements, which we didn't even begin to cover here, but also for its exploration of language use, community, and identity. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.